Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by the Expert Institute. There isn't anything more important to your case than finding the right experts, and there's no better place to find those experts than the Expert Institute. The Expert Institute has a whole team of people that will work with you to perform an individualized search for experts for each specialty you need for each case. And they'll keep looking until they find an expert that you're satisfied with. Go to theexpertinstitute.com and check them out today. Our episode is also being sponsored by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is the case management software solution that we use in my law firm to handle a wide variety of personal injury and complex medical malpractice cases. We love it. It's got forms, it's got work plans, it's cloud-based. And it allows us to track every case from beginning to end and the finances of our firm as well. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Our show today is also sponsored by Hype Legal. Hype Legal provides digital marketing, internet, and web-based design services for the high end of the trial bar. Every time I check them out, they've launched another firm's website. There's some really great sites, really cool stuff they're working on over there. If you've got a website that feels stale and old, you're looking for something new, or you're just starting out, I would encourage you to check them out at Hype Legal, HYPE legal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
Rahul, what's new in your world since the last time we did a show?
Oh, since the last time we did a show, my oldest son turned 16.
I saw that. Congrats.
Ah, thank you. No, it's exciting. And the best part about it, he still doesn't want a driver's license. So I don't have to worry about my 16-year-old on the road driving just yet. And same thing. Now I'm preparing for a trial on October 14th out in Las Vegas. So the court system's fully up and running, and I've been doing focus groups both online and in person in preparing for it. So a lot's been happening over here. Ben, how's your son doing at Wake Forest?
He's doing really well. We went out there for Parents Weekend last weekend. We came away with a good lesson, which is that when you go to Parents Weekend, you should spend no more than 24 hours with your child, because they don't want to see you for more than 24 hours. But we had a really fun time. We went to a football game, hit the tailgate. I did not go to a big college football school, so that was kind of a new experience for me. It was really fun.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
So we're really thrilled today to have Saira Pasha on the show. Saira is somebody who I've come to know in the last couple of months, and we're actually working together on a couple of cases right now as we speak. And the reason I wanted to have her on is because for lawyers who deal in cases that involve medical records, whether that's personal injury cases, product liability, or medical malpractice, which is mostly what I do, trying to understand the information that's being communicated through the medical records is really critical to our clients and success in these cases. And the more that I've focused on this issue, what I've learned, and a lot of what I've learned from Saira, is that even describing the medical record as one thing is incorrect. The medical record is a moving target and is different now depending on who's looking at it, what your purpose for obtaining the information is, and how you intend to use it, and what the hospitals and medical providers are willing to share with you, because it's all digitized and it's just a very different animal than what we've dealt with in the past. So having some understanding and expertise brought to bear on that can be really critical to success in your case. So I wanted to have Saira on to talk about that. But before we get into the details of the record itself, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, Saira, and how you got into this medical record business? What's your background?
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. First, I want to say that we have something in common. I have a daughter who's a freshman at Ohio State, and I'll be going this weekend to my first Ohio State football game, and I'm not a big football person either, so we share that experience. So
it'll be a lot of fun. I hope you have a good time.
I hope so. So I'm an attorney, and I actually chose a very non-traditional route originally. I did have my own small little practice for maybe about 2 years out, getting out of law school, but then I decided to go into professional liability claims. Initially, I worked at Illinois' largest medical malpractice carrier for physicians. After about 3.5 years there, I moved over to Illinois' largest health and hospital system, where I was responsible for all the medical malpractice cases, managing them for like two area hospitals. And that involves, you know, assigning defense counsel, managing the lawsuit from suit to resolution. Also, but it also involved helping with answering discovery, you know, and working with risk management staff. I did that for about a year and a half. And I decided that, you know, my daughter was about to go to college, and it had been several years with me doing this claims business. And I kind of wanted to actually go plaintiff and work at a plaintiff's firm. But like, what I originally did is I tried to pitch myself as like a behind the scene, like strategist or investigator. And it's really hard to, you know, pitch that without concrete examples, and yet you're not giving people confidential information about what you've done. So I gave my notice February of 2020, the month before COVID hit, which was terrible timing. And had I known, I probably would have stayed a little longer, but you know, you can't look back, it's done. And what happened is, you know, my dreams of joining a big plaintiff firm and pitching myself as a big strategist or investigator kind of had to be put on pause. I did talk to two firms, and they were like, we love you, but you know, the lack of any jury trials because of COVID, you know, has put all these firms in a cash flow chokehold that you can't understand. Not only are there no verdicts, but even the settlements, the defendants are like, you know, what I've heard is that they were taking advantage of the situation and lowballing even on settlement values. So they said, you know, can you come back when jury trials are back? And I was thinking, I'd love to, but you know, in the meantime, for the next year, I still need to earn an income. So I really was kind of stuck, and I thought, I don't want to do doc review. I definitely know that much. So I kind of sat there and brainstormed, okay, what am I good at that is valuable to attorneys that I can charge for, you know? And so I kind of just brainstormed, and I was like, you know, I think I should just be a consultant. I have this unique ability to be, you know, intuitive. I understand when you're on the defense, you are hands-on in investigating a claim because you interview everybody involved. You know what happened, right? The biggest challenge for plaintiff's attorneys is that they don't know what happened. They have an idea, but you know, imagine if I was at the hospital and I would get calls. Well, let's say once a week, I would talk to each of my hospitals, and every week we'd have this call where they would tell me about all the adverse events that happened. And I would have, it was like a tort exam where I'd be like, no, that, you know, okay, that's a bad outcome. That's not malpractice. Or like, oh, that's really bad. Get an attorney on that like now, you know? So it was constantly evaluating, listening to like what really happened. And having all that insight as to what really happened can help you when you're on this side, because you can put together, you see the facts that you in front of you and put together, okay, this is what likely happened. But the other benefit of working at the hospital system was that I was live in the EMR system. So on these phone calls, when they're telling me about adverse events that just recently happened, like fresh, I'd be in the patient's chart looking at live note-taking. A lot of times they were still a patient. So having that hands-on experience in the EMR was really invaluable, because I could see how people chart and what it looks like, you know, in the record system, like for looking at results, looking at imaging, documenting fluids or pressure ulcer checks, you know? Anyway, so moving forward, I decided to start my own consulting business. And the timing of it was beautiful, because in July of 2020, the Cook County, where I live in Chicago, the Cook County court system, they released an order mandating the case management order for medical malpractice cases, mandating the order, the production of audit trails within the first 6 months of filing suit. So that just was a game changer, because when I was working at the hospital system, I would say 5 to 10% of cases would ask for the audit trail. And that could, the 10% is probably generous. And even when we would produce it, you know, our thoughts were like, well, do they know what they're going to do with this? You know, the mentality is, okay, we'll give it to them, but most of these plaintiff attorneys don't even know what to do with them. But yeah, we'll go ahead and give it. So the process is, you know, I was the claims person. I'd say I have a designated contact in IT, or, you know, health information management. I'd say, hey, on this patient, can I get an audit trail? And they would send it over to me. And I would, you know, when I was new there, I'd ask them, okay, what do these columns mean? Then I would explain it to defense counsel. But I didn't focus much on it, because only a few cases asked for them. And I didn't even appreciate myself what could be done with them, because I had a job managing like maybe 150 cases, you know? So moving forward, after this order came out, you know, mandating the production of audit trails, I was like, well, you know, if everybody in Cook County is going to get them now and nobody knows how to read them, that's maybe something I can offer. It was like, just, I just thought maybe it would be like 5 to 10% of what I do. I might get a few phone calls. A year later, that's all I do. And it's growing like wildfire, because, you know, the more I talk to people and the more plaintiff's attorneys see what I'm doing with an audit trail, I have not met one client yet who was like, meh. All of them, I feel like I can see light bulbs going on every single time someone talks to me about audit trail, because they understand what it really is. And what it is objective information about the timeline of care that the patient received. It's metadata that the EMR system is collecting, not in any way thinking, you know, in consideration of a malpractice lawsuit, but because of HIPAA and HITECH compliance. So, you know, these audit trails exist outside of litigation, and these EMR systems have these pre-programmed reports in them. So it's not like you requesting an audit trail is making some IT person like code a new report just for you. It's not time consuming. It's not a burden. It's a matter of the right person putting in the patient's name and the dates, you know, that are applicable, and just hitting go, you know, and then you get this report that, like I mentioned, the biggest strength to me is the objectivity of it, because it's just facts about what portions of the EMR each user touched. So it goes to two things: the timeline of care and, you know, who was involved, but also data integrity. Because, you know, when you're looking at a medical record, of course, you want to make sure after an adverse event that nobody went in and changed anything. And that's, you know, I'm not trying, I definitely don't want to promote some kind of like paranoia about that, but it does occur. I've seen several instances of it. It's just, something that people do maybe in a knee-jerk reaction when something bad happens, to go ahead and just alter something, or maybe to write a CYA note that's extra thorough, and that looks actually more suspicious, you know? So,
we go back, when you talk about the EMR, which I think stands for electronic medical record, right? Mm-hmm. When we're, as lawyers, when we're seeking a medical record, we send out a request, and then we get something back. What are we asking for, and what are we getting?
Okay, so most attorneys, you know, there's a standard request. It doesn't matter where you are, you know, different states, but each state has its own, you know, authorization. And the process is, if it's at a hospital or a large, you know, company, like a health organization, there's dedicated staff that works in health information management. And it's their job to pull these records requests. They get them from attorneys. They get them from patients directly. They get them from sometimes like work comp, insurance carriers, a whole, you know, slew of different people send requests. And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and talk about the two major EMR systems, Epic and Cerner. They hold the combined about maybe a 50% market share of the EMR systems. And I think that number is higher when you look at hospital systems. So the process is that, you know, the representative is going to take this request, and depending on what kind of request it is. So if it's a patient request, they pull one report. If it's an attorney request, it's a legal medical record request. And, you know, you would think that one would be more inclusive than the other, right? But that's not always the case. And what I've seen is that sometimes the patient requests yields more information than the attorney one. So when EMR...
When you say the legal medical record, what do you mean by that?
So I mean, I think it's defined by, I think per state, but it could be broader than that. But what I mean in terms of the EMR is that when they, you know, when the EMR system is designed and the user has to input data into the computer, be it vitals, or a subjective free text area, like a note, the system, you know, has a data field for it. And so this is close to kind of like almost a computer programming, went to database management stuff. But essentially, all these data entry points, either, I'm going to make it really simple, either it's a yes or a no. Is this part of the legal medical record? Yes or no, right? And so depending on what category that is, you know, that determines whether it's going to be part of the legal medical record, like notes, operative reports, sure, you know, flow sheets, yes. But there are certainly multiple parts of the EMR system that are not considered part of the legal medical record, but are totally discoverable.
What are some of the examples of those types of things?
So I'll use Epic as an example, and I'm going to go with internal communications between providers, right? So that's not part of the legal medical record. But there are, just off the top of my head, I can think of at least three things that are not part. So one of them is sticky notes. So Epic has these little, you can think of them as like post-its. They're like little yellow squares that, you know, you have an option on your screen to click, you know, add sticky note. And then the person, a yellow box comes up, you write a text, some text on it. And it's meant to be something, you know, not critical to the chart. And it's like something short term and, you know, just FYI maybe. But once the user sees it, they can remove it. And they usually don't stay on for very long. But that's, so, you know, sticky notes would not be considered part of the legal medical record. Another thing is something that Epic has. It's kind of like Outlook. It's called InBasket. And it serves kind of like internal emails or messaging, not like text messaging. I want you like visualize Outlook. It kind of looks like that in terms of how it's set up. But in addition to like messages between providers, the system generates lots of automated messages to providers, like the results are ready, or hey, you didn't write a note yet, so finish, you know, this patient's chart is incomplete. And so it can also, you know, alert you to, there could be some private staff conversations. And I've seen that where the audit trail will tell me, you know, say message type, it'll say chart completion, or it'll say results. So I can kind of get an idea as to what the message is about. But some of them say staff, limited number of recipients. And those really get my interest because I'm like, ooh, somebody that's something private and I'm going to want to see that, you know. Or lastly, there's something called Secure Chat, which kind of looks like instant messaging. And that's like texting between providers. And, you know, if you Google it, sticky notes or secure chat, you can probably find some providers that have posted like how-to guides or informational piece pamphlets on them. And I've seen providers write in them, hey, just so you know, this is not part of the legal medical record, but it is discoverable. So please be careful about what you right in there. So I've seen like providers acknowledge in these publications that it is discoverable, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, again, mostly what I do is medical malpractice. So communications between providers can be critical to the case. And all of those parts of the chart you described, the sticky notes, the in-basket, and the instant messaging type of app, which I forgot the name for already, but that's a way, it sounds like, that providers would use the system to regularly communicate with each other about the patient's care, but that they never produce any of that information when you ask for the medical chart.
Right. That's not, and they'll say it's because it's not defined as part of the legal medical record. So I would say that, you know, there's the root of the issue is that, you know, when the data is being captured under the, you know, yes, no, it should be yes, but I guess that's a bigger battle to make sure that all communications are part of the legal medical record. And another thing real quick, are alerts that come up in the system. Since we're sticking with Epic, Epic has these alerts that come up real time. They're called best practice advisories, and they're triggered by settings that the hospital sets up, either by vitals, lab values, or other patient demographics, that alert the user to something that the hospital thinks is important enough to, you know, send a warning to, and it usually recommends a course of action, like an order set, for example. You know, so those alerts are not part of the legal medical record, but the audit trail tells you when these alerts come up.
I was just curious, what's the origin of these audit trails? Why did HIPAA or any other organization require that they be part of the EMR?
So this is going back to, like, I want to say 2009, but, you know, as technology progressed, we started using more systems to document patient information, HIPAA and HITECH put in rules twofold. One, to ensure patient privacy and security of the records, right? So, you know, making sure that nobody who, if it's digital, that people who were, you know, it's not like you have to physically go get the paper chart, because if you have the paper chart in your hand, you know who saw it, and that, you know, you could restrict the lock it up, right? It's something you can touch. If it's electronic and everybody in the system can go into it, technically speaking, then how do you safeguard a patient's privacy under HIPAA? So there's a privacy security component to it. And then there is a data integrity component to it, where you want to make sure that just because it's digital, that, you know, maybe on a paper chart, you would see if somebody crossed out something or, like, tried to erase something. There can be some, you know, forensic analysis you can do on paper, but with digital stuff, it can be really seamless, and it might not even look to the average person like you've done any edits at all. And so these audit trails, or these restrictions or rules about audit trails for EMR systems, were in place to protect the patient privacy and the integrity of their records.
Has there been any investigations or use of the audit trails by HIPAA or HITECH? And are any of those sort of a matter of public record, where healthcare providers are, you know, caught red-handed, not doing it the right way?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, these reports serve as, like, compliance measures. So if, you know, an investigator were to come, then they would maybe do a sampling of, like an auditor, you know, and just do a sample of charts. I would say what I've seen, the bigger issue is in smaller practices where you don't have an EMR giant like Epic or Cerner. You have a small clinic with a doctor with a limited budget, so they go with the cheaper EMR system. And I'm not criticizing that, but, you know, you get what you pay for. And so a lot of these systems that were maybe developed maybe between 2010 or maybe a little bit before that and a few years after that, a lot of these systems, some of them were even made overseas, and they marketed themselves as, you know, having audit trails, but they didn't have HIPAA compliant audit trails. And I've been dealing with some of that too, and there's been some big lawsuits about that, because, you know, when you buy an EMR system, you it kind of segues into the next topic, but there's certification. It's called OCR certification. And if an EMR system or any other kind of healthcare technology system, like a EKG machine, for example, has that, then you know that that technology is capable of producing a HIPAA compliant audit trail. So I've seen in the last year that I've been doing this, I've seen or researched a couple of smaller EMR systems face big DOJ lawsuits and judgments because their systems were not compliant with the rules.
I was going to ask you about the certification. We regularly request certified medical records, and they certify that in the certification that the record is accurate and complete. But what I think you've taught us now is that it isn't complete, or maybe it's a complete quote unquote legal medical record, how they choose to define that, but it does not contain all of the information and even all of the clinically important information about the patient's treatment and admission to the medical facility. So what are we supposed to take away? What is there any significance to a certification of medical records in, other than the rules of evidence significance of allowing you to, you know, authenticate them? But does other than that, does it mean anything?
What it really means is that the hospital is saying, I mean, I'm using hospital as an example, but that they have a system in place that designates certain documents as legal medical record, and this report pulled all of those categories that, you know, fulfilled that criteria, and that user pulled it. So it's an automated procedure. I don't want people thinking that they get this legal medical records request and somebody's, you know, painstakingly going over every single thing. No, they're hitting like a query, and it's, the query is pulling, okay, all these things from like radiology and nursing, and it's multifaceted, and it pulls data. It takes a few minutes to generate, no doubt. And then it pulls up what it pulls up, and the employee will just put it, burn it to a disk, and it's done. There's not a lot of like validation or like, you know, verification of what the system pulled against actually looking at the patient's chart. It's a very automated process. So that's why technology, understanding health information technology and clinical informatics, is really key to understanding how data is collected and produced then in response to these requests.
And in that vein, sometimes when you request records, you get really great electronic records that are bookmarked and tabbed out in a really helpful form. And they're OCR'd, so they're keyword searchable. And sometimes they're color, in color-coded, so the original color that would appear on the EMR is present in what you receive. Other times, and more commonly, what you get are black and white, not OCR'd, and not bookmarked or tabbed out in any logical fashion. In fact, in some instances, it seems like they almost go to great lengths to produce them in a disorganized fashion that makes it very difficult to work with them once you receive them. Is there a suggestion you have for attorneys in terms of how you request the records to get the, and I'm assuming that when you were in-house in risk management and defense counsel asked for the record, you give them the helpful version of the record, not the unhelpful one that the plaintiff's lawyers get, or maybe, you know, I'm being overly paranoid about that.
Well, I never personally produced medical records. That was a separate system. So, you know, claims and medical records are two different worlds in the hospital system. So I would say, you know, make your request. I would say, you know, maybe not use the standard form that you've always been using. Make it updated to reflect how records involve technology, and say you want it digital, because if it's digital, and you can say not scanned, you can say, I want it, you know, pulled directly from the system and printed from there, burned onto a CD. Because what you're talking about, I can visualize in my head, is the difference between the two really is that defense counsel likely, or the hospital, depending on the size of them, they could be printing the medical record and then scanning it in a way that's not recognizable, as opposed to burning it to a disk and sending that to you, or in a downloadable, otherwise electronic downloadable format. So I would say you want it not on paper scanned, but you want it electronic, you know, and fresh from the data pull, and not any intermediary in between, you know.
That's helpful advice. The cynical part of me says that we do ask for that digitally, but they, because we occasionally get the really good version. So I know it exists, but perhaps we just need to be more vigilant about it. Why don't we take a 30-second break, and then we'll be right back with our interview of Saira Pasha. I'd like to take a brief break now to thank our sponsors again, Smart Advocate, award-winning case management software for trial lawyers, Hype Legal, full services digital marketing and web design with a premium on beautiful design and aesthetics for the high end of the trial bar, and for Expert Institute, the place to go to get the best experts to help you win your case. You can check out all of our sponsors on our website at elevate.fm. That's elevate.fm.
This is fascinating, Saira. I actually don't practice medical malpractice litigation, but the whole context of all of this is obviously relevant to any area of law and litigation. But here's my question. Now that we've got sort of the framework of electronic medical records and audit trails, is there a way we can go through a for example of how this audit trail allows the patient and their lawyers to actually know what really happened versus wondering what happened?
Oh, where do I begin? So that's, like I said, that's all I've been doing in the last year. And I guess I can think of, I'll think of like maybe my favorite topics or maybe my favorite cases without divulging anything confidential. So I want you to imagine you have the paper medical records in front of you. And let's say that a nurse, you know, signed a note at noon. And let's say the next note you have is a doctor signing a note at 3. So what if, you know, something critical or important happened between 12 and 3 and you want to know what happened? Otherwise, without these notes, you wouldn't know. But if you were to look at the audit trail, you know, the audit trail doesn't show you like every single key that was touched, but rather the audit trail shows you all auditable actions that were performed by the user. And auditable actions are like view, edit, print, accept, save, modify, delete. Like think of those verbs. And so a lot of times they're views, which, you know, are great because let's say between 12 and 3 o'clock, I can tell that both the doctor and the nurse clicked on results review and on a lab value. And so maybe they didn't act on it. Or maybe I'll go with I'll do one example I had where a client hired me to look at a case involving sepsis and failure to timely diagnose and treat a patient for that. And with my hospital experience and having dealt with some sepsis cases on that end, I knew exactly what I was looking for in the audit trail. I knew what the criteria were, you know, to hit the sepsis alert. Even if I have never seen, you know, use this hospital system particular, you know, their EMR system, I knew that there were criteria with vitals, with, you know, whether the patient was tachycardic, whether the patient was had a fee, O2 stats, you know, saturation, etc. So certain lab values will trigger an alert. And what I did for this one client, they had the physicians in, but they had the hospital in only for agency, you know. And what I found out at the audit trail was that a nurse saw a sepsis alert that went off, and contrary to policy, she didn't notify any physician about it. So now I have the nurse, I have evidence that the nurse saw the sepsis alert, and I can see what her actions are. I can see like it, you know, I'm going to make up a time. Let's say it's at 4 o'clock and she's in the chart for like 5 minutes going back and forth on this alert, but then nobody else is in the chart for like the next hour. It doesn't look like she notified anybody because nobody's taking any action. When a sepsis alert goes off, action is taken pretty quickly and a lot of people are in the chart. There's like orders for like lactated ringers, et cetera. There's so many things that occur in response to a sepsis alert, you know, usually broader spectrum antibiotics, a whole slew of tests come up. And so I can tell when someone takes action on an alert because I see all that activity, but the lack of any activity or any physician going into the chart after this nurse saw the sepsis alert is clearly, it shows me that she didn't tell anybody about it. And so now, you know, my client who originally had the hospital in only on maybe a weak agency theory now has the hospital in for direct, you know, a direct allegation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Rahul, just to give some more color onto your question, I mean, the last two jury trials I've tried, the audit trail has been a critical part of the evidence we presented to the jury involving witnesses from the hospital who came in and under subpoena and it had to explain what the audit trail meant. But what we've used them to show is exactly like what Syra's saying, sometimes what doesn't happen. So a critical imaging study gets done. It shows something that needs to be acted on. There's testimony about what people did in response, but you can look in the audit trail and see that nobody looked at the imaging. for, you know, 2 hours, or nobody accessed it at all, because if they were to access it, it would show up on the log, and it didn't happen. So it really is very, as Syra alluded to before, one of the great parts about it is it's objective evidence. You get a lot of retrospective accounts of what people say happened, particularly in medical cases. But the audit trail is something objective and difficult to challenge, because it just is what it is. If you access the chart, it shows up on the audit trail. And if you have no access, nobody looked at it. And there's no way you can really dispute that. One thing I learned from you, Syra, recently in a case we're working on together is, just like the medical record, when we had talked about a medical record, but it's really very different depending on who asks for it and what categories they choose of information they choose to give you. There's also lots of different audit trails and access logs, right? It's not just one monolithic thing. And it, what information you're going to get is going to depend, again, on what you're asking for, right? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So when we say the word audit trail in the medical malpractice community, everyone kind of defaults to the understanding that it's the patient audit trail, right? So when we request these audit trails from the hospital, the defendant hospital, and the designated employee who pulls it, there's going to be a set report and a pre-programmed report in the EMR system called audit trail or access log, and they just generate that report. But that's just one of like maybe tens or hundreds of potential reports. I mean, when I talk about Epic, there's a ton of pre-programmed reports available to these IT individuals, like that is really about clinical informatics and helping each department like see like maybe intelligence as a whole, like, okay, for the anesthesia department, how many incidents did we have of this issue, for example? So hospitals are using these really intelligent systems to improve patient care, but these reports are pre-programmed. And so when you say audit trail, okay, that's one report, the patient audit trail. But there are other audit trails in Epic. It depends on, you know, and not for every single thing, but all the big ticket items. Let's say orders. Orders are very important. There's an order audit trail. There's a document audit trail. So I can say, give me the audit trail or history of this order number. And the order number is often in the printed medical records, but sometimes it's not. It is in the audit trail usually.
So can you, on that, for an order, if you wanted to do an audit trail of an order, what would you be seeing there that would be different from what you get from the patient audit trail?
It's usually just a little bit more detail as to who saw it, and all the steps, maybe like if it was transmitted but it was on hold, or if a provider, you know, viewed it but didn't sign it right away, the extra details, right? And so if you're wondering, like in a case that I recently worked on, there were I have to be careful about confidentiality, but let's just say there was two inconsistent order numbers in the patient. There was one order number for something in the audit trail. And for the same order, like the thing that they were ordering, subject matter, there was a different order number in the printed medical record for the same thing at the same time. And that was kind of confusing because which one was the right one? And especially it mattered because later on, it looked like that order was never entered. Either one was never acted upon. So that kind of leads to some confusion as to like, was this order? Because, you know, the process of ordering, there's so many different ways an order can go through. The provider can enter it directly because they just came up with an order. But, you know, what people don't understand in the business is that there's a lot of order sets, right? So, you know, when I talk about, you know, intelligence in the EMR system, let's say a patient presents to the emergency department with any number of, let's go with chest pain, right? Or headache or something. You know, these EMR systems will have order sets available to these providers with standing orders like, okay, ED chest pain, ED sepsis, ED this. You click on it and a whole like, folder of orders opens up to the provider with different options like labs, medications, imaging orders, some of them already being like checked off, meaning they're recommended and you have to uncheck them. And some of them are not checked off, but you have them in front of you. So it's not like when something happens, they're sitting there thinking, what should I order? It's like right in front of them. And that's based on a lot of research and intelligence for different, a constellation of symptoms, you know?
Interesting. So if you wanted to, if the case turned on whether a particular order was executed or who did it and when, you would want to have the order audit trail. The patient audit trail probably isn't going to give you all of that.
You start with the patient audit trail.
You start with it, right?
So I would, the biggest thing I would tell people is that, you know, I don't advocate any kind of, you know, sense of paranoia of anything. Like, just like medical records, it is what it, like you mentioned, it is what it is. So like, I think that people, attorneys in this business, both defense and plaintiff, need to understand that I think audit trails are going to be part of all investigations going forward, I can see the next few years, because they're so rich with information about the care the patient received. So for, and to go to your example about orders, yeah, I would get an order audit trail, but really the starting point is just get the patient audit trail and then take it from there, because you're going to see so many things on there and you're definitely going to be issuing a supplemental discovery in response to what you see. You can ask for the order audit trail from the beginning and there's no harm in that. But what I would say, especially if an order is in question, you know, I want people to think about order sets, and because, you know, either whether something was ordered or not, whether, you know, other orders with could have been ordered with it, other tests, for example, other labs. So it's not like orders are done like in a vacuum. They're kind of part of this whole system. And there's a lot of information available to the providers that people, the attorneys don't see because they've never had the benefit of being in an EMR, right? So that it's just life-changing to see. I think it'll change how you practice if you understand how EMRs are used. And I'll give one tip to your listeners. Go to YouTube. Like, you know, there's so many providers who show how-to videos for their various EMR systems on YouTube. So much of the investigations that I do for my clients, I start with YouTube. Like Cerner, all the, some of the smaller EMR systems. And I saw the other day an ED physician showing how to admit a patient in Epic. It was a very good video and it showed everything I was talking about. And you can really marry the audit trail to the records by looking at how this doctor is showing you how he admits a patient. So once you see how an EMR is used, and you know, you'll have a deeper understanding of how much information is available to you or is in the system, and then you have to go get it, of course.
From your work on the claims side and seeing probably a lot of interesting and kind of diverse issues that have arisen at for various medical providers you were involved in working for, and then the litigation that comes out of that and the plaintiffs attempting to prove their cases, What are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen on the plaintiff side in trying to put together those cases where they're missing critical information or not understanding really what happened that you knew being on the inside that would have allowed them, if they had understood that, to prove their cases?
Oh, that's a difficult question, because that I don't think I have a standard response to that. Because each case is so different. There have been cases that are very cut and dry, and it's very obvious to know like what could have gone wrong. But I've had cases where they haven't figured it out. You're just kind of waiting to see if they're gonna ask the right questions or not. And of course, you know, all the treaters, defendants, et cetera, are coached not to over-answer any questions for depositions and to keep their answers to a minimum and don't volunteer information. And that's just typical. That's good. I mean, that's a good defense. I'm not criticizing defense attorneys for, you know, for doing that. But in terms of broader advice, I don't know that I have any because they're so case specific. But from what I see is like, don't get too attached to a theory. Let the evidence take you where it does. Like, don't think you know what happened, or you have one theory as to what happened, and you're so like laser focused on that that you might miss a whole other theory because you're focusing on something else. So look, I would say take a fresh look at it periodically throughout your case to see what you know you've gotten through discovery, and like pretend you've never seen it before, you know, or like pretend your client hasn't told you anything and you're just looking at this case for the first time. Do you see anything new, you know? And then secondly, I would say, if I had any advice about this, is with your e-discovery, you know, wording is everything. Okay. So it's very easy to say there's nothing responsive to this request when you word it the wrong way. So I'm going to go with, I'll use sticky notes as an example. Sticky notes are temporary, right? They're little post-its on the screen. They usually don't last more than 24 to 48 hours. So if a plaintiff attorney were to ask for, produce all sticky notes, it's very easy for the defense to say, sorry, they don't exist anymore. They've been removed. We don't have them. The key thing is to ask for the content of the sticky notes, right? Because you're not looking for the actual physical sticky note or picture of it. You just want to know what it said, right? So, you know, the data from the sticky note is recorded in the system. So you want the content of the note, or not the actual note, you know? That's an example. Wording is everything for e-discovery. And, you know, I think people just have to be really smart about it. And also when they're drafting e-discovery, or when they even get investigate a claim, one of the first questions they should ask themselves is, which EMR system am I dealing with? And it doesn't sound like that's something that should be thought of in the beginning, but it should, because then you know what kind of discovery you can draft. Is it Epic? Is it Cerner? And you could do a little bit of research online. A lot of these EMR systems have, like I said, there's so many tools online that are pamphlets that'll tell you, like, let's use a smaller EMR system that are for like little clinics. Oh, there's so much online about, oh, these are all the user reports, all the audit logs we have available, access log, this, that. Like for example, Centricity. That's a smaller EMR system, but they have a wealth of information online as to all the different kind of audit reports that they have. So if you are drafting discovery for your case, you should think about first, which EMR am I dealing with? And sometimes you can tell by looking at the paper records. If you're not sure, two tips are just to Google the hospital system and the word EMR, because a lot of times when hospitals upgrade to a big EMR or migrate over to one, they sometimes issue a press release because it looks good. Like, oh, look at us. We're your local hospital. We're getting up to date. We're updating our technology. So they issue a press release, and there's something on the internet for that. The other tip I give people is to look at the job openings for the hospital, because if for like maybe the nurses or IT staff, and the description for the job might be like, oh, experience with Epic preferred, or something like that, that tips you off as to what EMR system it is.
Well, these are really helpful pointers. We really appreciate it. I would suggest to our listeners that another approach would be to call Syra and ask her to help you with all of this stuff in your case, because that's what we've been doing. And we found her to be invaluable in helping us through some of these issues and in some of our cases. So if folks want to get in touch with you, Syra, can you tell them how to find you?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's called, my business is called Medical Malpractice Claim Consultants. And the web address is medmalclaimconsultantsingular.com. And they can email me at info@medmalclaimconsultant.com. I'm going to be doing a website upgrade in the near future. Actually, my website does not mention anything about audit trails, but it will be soon. And, one other thing is that I'm very excited to tell you guys is that, you know, I'm sure you guys are aware of the American Association for Justice. There's an organization for plaintiff attorneys of all kinds. And there's a 3-day conference that they're doing in November in Atlanta called Mastering the Medicine. And I'm going to be a speaker there. So if any of your listeners are going to be attending that, then, you know, definitely give me a heads up. And I'd love to meet in person over there.
That sounds great. We really appreciate you joining us today. We learned a lot.
Thank you so much, Syra.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.